welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Feature Interview. Today I have a fabulous guest that I stole from Brian Scuttle's show. So don't listen to Brian Scuttle's show, listen to my show. I stole his guest, Chris Esper. Welcome, and he brought two short films. One is Imposter, one is Undertaker, and Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Simon. Great to be here.
Yeah, the show is Sonic Cinema, but we're not promoting that today. With no Sonic
That's
Cinema.
That's right.
No Sonic Cinema shows on this one.
Sorry, Brian.
So let's start at the very beginning. Where does the imposter come from? With short films, you have to get in and out quickly. You don't have a lot of time to do half an hour, even sometimes. It's not time you have. Sometimes right. You have enough budget for 12 minutes. So why imposter? Mm-hmm. Why 12 minutes? And where does it start?
Sure. So let's see. So by that point in my short film career, I've done a couple of like comedies. I've done a few short dramas, not many. So it was sort of a way to mature as a filmmaker, but also to dig a little bit deeper within to try to see, okay, you know, what's a unique way I could tell a story? And one of my favorite types of filmmaking is anything avant-garde, experimental. Anything with no dialogue, or especially silent cinema, those of even the early days of like Chaplin and then so forth. So it was an opportunity to sort of experiment with that. But more importantly, it was a way to sort of express the idea, okay, what's something personal for me? And that being, and like I feel very strongly, have a deep connection with the subject of anxiety and anything mental health related, just because I have a deep empathy for those that go through that. And so I wrote this script about – now, there have been plenty of films about anxiety before. Let me just preface by saying that. So the subject is nothing new. What I figured was, okay, how can I do this differently without using dialogue even? Because I felt like with dialogue, it would be too obvious in a way, maybe a little bit too heavy-handed. So I'm like, okay, what's a different way I could do this? So then it naturally felt – I felt the need to do it silently for the very reason that anxiety for me is a silent disease in the sense that those that go through it we don't see what others are going through, but they know what's going on within them internally. So I thought that would be an interesting way to show that. And I guess for me, anxiety is sort of like a personified other being of sorts that could always remind you of the things that you're scared of or the things that you're afraid of. Like that might be the person, it might be the personification might be someone tapping you on the shoulder constantly saying, you suck, you suck, you suck. And of course we know it's not true in our logical mind, but anxiety says otherwise. And so that was the basis of the film, was the idea of personifying anxiety and showing the point of view of people with anxiety and show, like for example, on the bus scene in that film, the idea was to show how everyone of all walks of life, of all kinds, they all have something that they're going through. Whether we see it or not, doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And so that was the impetus behind that film. I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
I'm sorry, I should really hit mute occasionally. It might help.
It's okay.
You said you're very influenced by silence films. So when you're looking this, I mean, there are comedies, mainly silent films. They're not really heavy things.
Right.
I mean, influence you mentioned were Keaton.
Chaplin.
And Chaplin, which, I'm sorry, did not do anything that heavy. I mean, they did some great films, but most of it's comedy-related. Yeah.
Well, so when I say silent films, I mean more in the sense of the expression of it, not so much because of their comedies. But you know, there have also been some pretty serious German expression of silent films too, like Nosferatu, I think is a beautiful film. So it wasn't necessarily those films that influenced Imposter. It's more they were able to communicate so much emotionally without dialogue because there was no sound. And so it was really about taking the bare bones of filmmaking, going back to the basics and saying, okay, you know, what's a good way to express? And doing it silently just seemed the most natural. But films without dialogue, I mean, there are so many that came after that, they're just so powerful. One of my favorite short films is actually The Red Balloon. It's a French film from the 1950s. The whole thing has no dialogue. It's just a little boy chasing a balloon. And it's beautiful. And like, you know, whatever it means is, I don't know. But I mean, I just think it's a lovely little movie.
So when you're doing yours, does this all cross your mind, or are you trying to be Chris Esper film? Like, that's what I'm asking here. You sound like you're modeling yourself on something, but are you modeling, or are you, or maybe even channeling? I'll accept channeling, but I want a Chris Esper film. Is this a Chris Esper film, or is this an homage to what you remember?
No, it's definitely what I. It's definitely comes from me, without a doubt. But very often when I'm making a film, I will often Imposter, I didn't do this with, but with other films I've done, I have, where I'll look for visual influences, or I'll look for inspiration, I should say, and be like, okay, I could sort of see this style of shooting being employed here, let's say, for example. So I'll often tell my cast and my crew, hey, watch this. In the case of Undertaker, I did this. Like, I'll say, hey, watch this film, get a sense of, you know, style, costume, set design, and visuals that I'm after here. Not so much with acting. It's more just for inspiration for the actors to get a sense of what the vision is. Imposter, I didn't do that because there really wasn't a particular film that inspired me there. It was more style that inspired me, and I didn't want that to impose on the actors because that was a purely emotional experience for that film. And there was nothing I could tell my cast and crew to watch, really. There was nothing I watched either. That film, it was so instinctual. I knew how to shoot it. I knew how to put it together. I knew exactly what to tell the actors. So that was a rare instance, I would say, where I didn't really watch any films prior to that.
Now, did you think this film should really go to schools? I thought it was definitely an educational film at times. That you should be sending this to schools for mental health issues. Like, just saying, hey, if you identify with any of this, please go seek some help, which you don't really say, but you kind of do at the same time. You know, I thought this would be a perfect film for schools, and maybe that's how you were marketing it.
We did the film festival circuit. It did very well there, won some awards. We did talk about doing schools. We just never got around to it for some reason. I mean, not that we can't, we certainly still could. I mean, you know, that's something that's always relevant in today's society. It's definitely relevant for schools, particularly college age, I think, you know, where anxiety, I think, really wraps up as you're going to adulthood, you're going into trying to figure out what you are as a person, what you're going to do with your life. So certainly it could be used for schools. Absolutely.
Now, at the start of the film, you have a quote.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you pull your quotes from? I mean, obviously, I know where the quote came from, but why that quote? Do you find the quote supposed to help the movie, or something you find inspirational, or why a quote?
The quote was simply just a precursor to sort of give the viewer an idea of what the film might be about without actually saying anything. We did it because, well, several reasons. So I love that quote. That's one thing. And the crew also... Well, my producer and I, we talked about it a lot, and she also liked it. But also, in testing the film, because I always send my films to people I know to get their thoughts on it, feedback, if they like something, they don't like something, if something could be different or change. You know, I try to listen as much as I think that's important for any filmmaker to do that. But there were a few that didn't really quite understand what the film was about at first, because I didn't really give a clue in the beginning. I mean, some got it, that others were like, okay, is this about death? Is this about something else? So I put that quote in the beginning, not so much to spoon feed the audience, I shouldn't say that, no, but to, I guess, sort of give a precursor of what is to come and what the catalyst of the film is, really.
Now, do you find the music is more of what you're after to set the mood? Because I think you have to. You're not using any dialogue in your film at all. So I have to depend on the music you chose. Your first note has to tell me what we're going to do in this film. Did you find that worked? I did. But do you get that audience feedback?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I did. Yeah. Now, music was terribly important in that film, as are all movies, I feel like. I mean, it depends. Obviously, you don't want music to manipulate a viewer. Certainly if you're doing some kind of romantic drama or some kind of tearjerker, you don't want the music to dictate the feeling or the emotion. But because this was such a, because again, there's no dialogue, music was terribly important. So I worked very closely with my composer on this, and we chose sort of a Philip Glass type of vibe to the music, where it was, you know, a lot of like heavy drone kind of music, a lot of ambient sounds, no real instruments of sorts, just more ambience. And we also gave the characters different ambient sounds that associate with them. The painter, for example, was played by Chatel Kelkar. She had a more of a lighter kind of tone, whereas the lead character, well, I shouldn't say lead character, it's ensemble, but the lead businessman, Tom Mariano's character, he had more of a heavier drone kind of sound. So we kept the same theme throughout, but they just sounded just a little bit different. I gave each character an identity throughout the whole piece.
Now, do you find, do the actors hear the music ahead of time or no?
No, there was no music at the point of the time of shooting.
So that you have to get, okay, so there's a good point. What direction do you give them then? Because you definitely have to make them convey what you want.
Right. Well, it's difficult. I mean, we did several takes of each, did many takes actually of every scene. I would, first of all, because a lot of the characters are in pairs a lot of the time, you know, with the character along with their counterpoint, I would often have the two actors work together, talk to each other, and collaborate on a biography, because in theory, these two characters are the same person at different stages of their life. So what I would do is I would say to them, hey, you know, can you two work together and develop a biography for your character? We'll come together, we'll meet, and then we'll discuss it. And so I would hear what they have to say, and then I would give my interpretation as well. And from that, I would just, when we, that way, by the time we got to the set, there were no questions asked. They knew exactly what to do. And there was no question of like, how do I play this? Is this right? And obviously if there was an adjustment, I would give them the adjustment right on the spot. So I would try to direct them not for an emotional result. I don't think you want to direct with, you don't want to simply say be anxious or be sad. You know, you want to give more context for what that means. So I would try to give them something playable. I would give them a situation, a word or a thought or idea. And usually that would take them to that place. Particularly the scene of the art gallery, that scene, I think we did the initial shot, the first initial shot of that, I think like maybe three or four times. And, it got more and more emotional every single time, to the point that when we got to the last take, everybody in the room was crying. It was a very emotional situation. And so that when we had to do the next shot, I had to tell the actress, hey, you know, take it easy on this one. Because I knew she had worn herself out. I'm like, yeah, let's not do the same thing again and again. Let's switch around to another spot where she's not on camera, because that's something you don't want to do as a director. You don't want to wear your actors out to the point that where they shot it all out of the park and it's gone and they have nothing else to work with.
I do want to touch on one outfit, the jester outfit. Do you have one of those handy? Did you buy it? Did you rent it?
No, we bought it. Nope. No, we bought it specifically for the film. I don't know who owns it now. I think probably the actor that, then probably the kid that wore it. I think he just kept it as a souvenir. I don't remember what happened to it.
Interesting. So you just give away things. So I should come on one of your films to get free items. I get how it works.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. My new wardrobe, come to my set. Exactly.
right? Where did you find a giant bus?
That was a challenge. we looked everywhere. We talked to different bus terminals. We talked to some of the bigger bus terminals. Nobody wanted to do it. Or we just didn't hear from anyone. And then finally, I found this one bus terminal that was here in New England, in Massachusetts. I contacted them. I sent them the script and I said, here, this is what we're doing. And the guy who I was talking to was like, wow, I can relate to this. Sure, I'll be glad to help you out. And he gave us a good deal, you know, almost virtually for nothing. I mean, not totally for free, but I mean, it was like virtually nothing. And he had the driver come to our location, which was like at least a good, 40 minutes away from where the terminal was. And the bus driver, to his credit, he was there for at least like, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours of us driving around a parking lot for 4 or 5 hours. We're getting different takes, different angles, different shots. And he was very patient. So Yeah, so that's where I got the boss. It was just simply by asking. That was probably the toughest thing to get for that film.
I wanted to say, I'm pretty sure you only shot that parking lot because it looked like a parking lot to me, but that's just me being me. Checking. I'm like, yeah, they never went on the road, it looked like. It looked like it was always the same place. So I was wondering, did you have them drive forward and back it up, or did you just drive around to do it again?
It was just a circle, you know, really. And of course, we made sure the windows were dark, so you couldn't see too much of what was going on outside.
You cannot. You know,
No, you cannot. So, we just kept going. We just kept going around and around for like 4 or 5 hours, and very patient driver.
The gallery, the art gallery. Is this a real art gallery, or did you just put stuff on a wall?
Nope. That is actually the same office as the opening scene where the lead character is sitting at a board meeting. We just redressed the room entirely, and we just made it look different. But different lighting, we redid it, basically. It was one of those situations where the budget was small, and we had one solid location that we could use, so we just used that location to our advantage as much as we could, and use different angles and try to shoot in a very smart, economic way. That way, it looked like different places, even though it was not, and it was all done in one day.
So where did you get artwork come from? Did you borrow it? Did you order it from Amazon?
A lot of it was donated from local artists that I've known over the years or people just they donated their work. The main art pieces that the artist has, those were done by a friend of a friend that I've known for a little bit. And she's a production designer and painter, and she agreed to have her paintings featured in the film.
So when you're doing this, I do want to get into, you definitely focus on faces. Like all the actors seem to have different faces and different looks. And definitely when they hand around a certain item, I find that's really relevant. And that's kind of point I was hoping maybe you were looking for the film. When the face tells me and then the item tells me, and that's when I started feeling overwhelmed. Like I was like, oh my God, how much more of this can I take? And was that your plan to have your audience just going, we're done at this point?
No, I wanted them to feel anxious because, you know, that's the whole point, is to build up that anxiety. And we had a few more. I know what scene you're talking about. We had a few more instances where we go to other people in different seats and, you know, they have different things that they're doing or going through. There was a point where too much was too much, and we had to cut some of it back. So there's actually a few things we cut out. But ultimately, we left what we thought were like the more relevant performance. Not relevant, I shouldn't say that. Powerful moments and more, I guess, relatable moments than anything else, and ones that really came across the way we had hoped. So we just kept the ones that give like little glimpses, and then we focused on our three main characters, I guess you could say.
Okay. I felt maybe you missed some issues, but I felt every issue I personally could think of was touched on that bus seat. Was there something you wanted to touch on that you couldn't?
Nope. Everything was there pretty much. Again, we did cut a few moments out. Like there was a moment with a character suffering from OCD. We cut that out. There was also another one where I forget what kind of anxiety it was, but it was just a different type. It didn't really come across the way we wanted, so we cut it out. Same with the OCD one. It just like it was there, but not quite there. So we're like, yeah, this is not adding to it. Yeah, let's cut it. So we cut the stuff that we felt that there was. It was coming to a point where it's like, okay, we got it. We don't need to nail this over the head over and over again. So anything that we felt was too much, we just cut it out.
Was there ever a different ending for the film? Because I find the ending film, I put in my notes a rough ending, but just because I don't want to ruin anything.
Oh, no, it's fine. there wasn't a different ending. I've had people ask me in the beginning. They're like, my producer was like, are you positive about this ending? I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm definitely positive about it. because it felt like a cop out to not do it that way. Like almost like I was like, you built up and then, you know, that's all, you just, you don't go there. It didn't really have the same impact without it, I felt. So yeah, so that's that ending was there.
I don't know how to say this. Do you face harsh criticism at film festivals if you go?
Oh yeah, I've gotten criticism. Well, yeah, every filmmaker gets criticism. So yeah, I've certainly faced criticism many of times. Yeah.
I just meant that people were coming after you for the end of the film, just going, oh, what are you doing?
No. I did go to a festival in Vegas one time with a buddy of mine, and we played the film, and the crowd for the most part seemed to get it and seemed to appreciate it. I can't say for sure if they liked it, but it's played all right. But I remember one question was, why did you kill the children at the end? And I'm like, wait, hold on a second. We never killed anyone. We're implying that we killed their anxieties. We didn't ever say anything about killing children. So I think there's like sort of a fine line, but I can understand where the misinterpretation comes in.
I do. I could see where that question was coming from. I didn't see it, but I see where it was coming from.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting. Many people interpret it in different ways. Like I had someone that say, okay, is it about losing a loved one? Like, are those other counterparts a loved one that they lost? I'm like, okay, interesting interpretation. I could sort of see where you would get that. Not what I was going for, but I mean, hey, you know, I mean, that's the name of the game. And I like having a dialogue about this kind of thing. I mean, that's kind of the fun thing about doing this stuff is that you learn what people's tastes are, what they like, what they don't like. So, yeah. So, I mean, I love discussing this stuff because, you know, it challenges you as an artist.
Well, I have my one last question about the film. Did you time them when they were coming down the stairs, or did you have each one as an edit?
That's funny you say that. So at first we just did it where they just came off, but then it was a little bit too slow. Then my producer, she just stepped in and goes, all right. She goes, all right. I said, we're going to do it like this. All right. One, two, three. And then one person comes out. One, two, three. Next one came. So it was me.
I was counting right. I'm like, it looks like a timed entrance.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, that wasn't the intent at first, but it was the only way to do it. Correctly.
But I think it works. Do it.
Yeah, no, it does. Because like some would come off too slow or too fast, and it's like, wait a minute, hold on, we got to get the choreography better here.
I think that gives you time to process each actor as they come off.
Exactly. Yep.
And then you're like, but we also need to think about.
Exactly. Well, we also needed to time it too, particularly for, well, again, not to give anything away, but for one key visual effect in the film, we had to time it specifically because that actor does not look like that, you know, with the arm. That was all CGI.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. So, okay. Yeah. I'm going to move on to Undertaker now, if that's okay with you. I think I did a pretty good job of the first one.
That's great. Yeah.
Okay, Undertaker, again, starting the film off with another quote. So now I'm going to ask, mm-hmm. Is this a continuous thing I'll see in your work?
No, only in those two films. Oh, no, wait. Sorry. In another film I did do that, but normally, no. It's not usually my thing. But with these two films in particular, it felt kind of appropriate to start with them. Again, this film, no, so I should preface by saying Undertaker, I did not write. My friend and actor, Chris Selvey, he wrote the script. And I loved it when I read it, but it was one of those scripts that I had to read a few times to really understand what it was I was reading. Because, I love surrealism. I love experimental cinema. But I also know that that's sort of a very niche sort of genre. And the last thing I want to do is alienate an audience from understanding what it is I'm trying to say or do. So the quotes, I like using them because they give it sort of a certain style, but also because it sort of gives a thematic tie to what we're trying to do. And Chris and I discussed what the interpretation of his script was. And we both came to an agreement that was about what the quote talks about, which I don't remember the quote off the top of my head verbatim, but it's something to the effect of, about performance and about how we're all, it's not about playing a role necessarily, but about just really about how we're perceived, about perception. That's it, perception. And that to me is what the film's about. It's about perception.
Now, you just said you don't want people to perceive the film differently. My argument is, what would you like the film? I mean, don't you want your film just to stand on its own and people to take away what they want?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, certainly. Okay. Yeah, for sure.
Just by the way you said that, perceived. My argument is we could both go see the same film and we would come out with something different. Even one of your films. We could both go in with, you have mm-hmm. your vision. This is your film. You've created. You have your ending. Especially with this one.
Yeah.
And I bet I probably have a very different take on the ending than 100 other people. So how director,
that's great. Yeah.
You going into a film and putting a quote is going to help me direct me, I guess is what I'm saying.
Oh, not that I should. No, I didn't mean to say that it helps the viewer, but it's sort of, but it gives the viewer, to me anyway, it gives the viewer sort of not a handle. I'm trying to think of the right word for it. I guess sort of a concept of what they're about to see. Not necessarily, oh, this is exactly what it is, but more it's a concept of what it could be about. I think that's what I'm trying to say, ultimately, with those.
Okay. The film is black and white, which I think works amazing, but I did not know that at the beginning. Now, I got to say it works black and white because I finished the film. But coming into this film and shooting black and white nowadays, it's a very bold choice, I would say. So why black and white? I do understand because I've seen the film. Right. But when I'm first thinking of it, I don't know if I would have thought black and white.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's interesting. When I read the script that Chris wrote, I'm reading it over and over again. And for some reason, and when I read a script, I try to visualize it, too. At the same time, I'm trying to read the story. And I'm visualizing the shots, the photography, and what have you. And as I'm visualizing it, I just kept seeing black and white. I could not see anything in color. I'm like, huh, this would be cool in color. I haven't shot a black and white film since I was a film student in college. And I know black and white, you're right, it is bold in some way. And also it has a... It has a certain connotation to it, black and white. A certain pretense to it, which I could totally understand why some would find it, why some would think that way about it. But I don't know. I guess I kept thinking of, like, again, going back to influences, I kept seeing this as, like, oh, this is sort of Twilight Zone-esque. This is sort of Night Gallery. This is sort of... a very vignette type of story with something certain that's trying to say that gives a certain that, of course, people walk away with different interpretations at the end of it. So it just felt very appropriate. I didn't necessarily watch Twilight Zone in preparation for it, but I did see it. The film I actually was most influenced by when reading it was Andrei Tarkovsky's Stalker, which Brian and I actually did speak of on an episode of his podcast, and it's a beautiful film, really beautiful.
It is, and I can see where you're going. I will give you totally see where you're going with Stalker on this one. I have seen Stalker, so.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful. I mean, for those who haven't seen it, it starts, you know, sort of a sepia 4x3, then it goes into a color world. And if I remember correctly, I think even the ratio is bigger too. It's more widescreen. And I don't remember. It's been a while since I've seen it, but
I call it the long shots. It does tons of long shots.
Yeah. Tons of long shots. A lot of 10 minute takes, camera on the dolly, moving very slowly. And I did that here too. And if you notice, I didn't move the camera very much in that film. That was intentional because I wanted the dialogue and the acting to stand out. Not so much my photography. So the photography in Undertaker is more methodical than it was in Imposter, where the camera moves just a little bit more, I feel like.
So again, with the bus, you had a problem finding the bus in your last film we discussed. This is, I mean, is such a location driven film. And I'm saying, if you don't shoot this in the right spot, I think it would blow everything. I think it would blow the era. I think it would blow the look. So let's start with the easy part. How hard was it to find the diner and the forest? Is that all one place?
Nope. Not all one place. We're actually traveling between different parts of Massachusetts. I'm from New England. Let's see. So the opening scene at the train station, that was in Gardner, Massachusetts. And then, oh no, I'm sorry, Shirley, Massachusetts. And then the diner, it's in Gardner. That's like a good 20 minutes away. And then the ending was done in Fitchburg, which is at least, I don't know, a good 50, 45 minutes away. When we did this in a period of, I think it was a 3-day shoot that we did this. Yeah, it was three different days of shooting. The first 2 days were focused on the train station and the ending of the film. Then the second day was pretty much all diner. And then the last day, we just did a few extra pickup shots that we missed during the first 2 days. So it was, it was done in that procedure basically. And, so locations, they weren't too difficult. Luckily that part of central Massachusetts, not much has changed. Like a lot of the locations there, they look as they did, 50 years ago or so. So, I mean, it was like almost easy to get these locations. So it was nice to be able to have that. Man, Chris, he's from that area, so it was he knew all the places. He would be like, here, try this place, try that place. And it was just a matter of talking to the town for all these different things. The diner, we just talked to the owner. Owner allowed us to shoot there. Actually, the diner where we shot, Blue Moon Diner, they've also the movie School Ties with Matt Damon. I forget who else. Oh, Ben Affleck, Brendan Fraser, I believe.
Yep.
I could be wrong on Brendan. So that was like early 90s, like 1992. Yes. That movie was actually shot there. So they're very film friendly, that diner, I found. So it was great. You know, it was great to be able to use that location. That was all fun.
Only thing about him with the diner, and I don't know if you even noticed, you have a shot as he's leaving and they show license plates. That was the only thing that kind of took me out was the license plates. I'm like, if you had removed those license plates, I never would have known what era we were supposed to be.
Right. A lot of that was like funny that you say era, because the thing of it is the script was not written for a very specific era. It was actually, when I was reading it, a lot of it felt appropriate that they should dress a certain way and that certain they should get into a period specific car, even though the film has nothing to do with period at all. So, but it felt appropriate for some reason. I'm reading the script. I'm like, man, this just screams period for some reason. So funny you should say that, but yeah, a lot of that was fun to do as well. Choosing the costumes, the car, you know,
okay, we're going to get to costumes next, but I want to go back to the diner scene, the actual scene.
Yeah.
The chemistry on your lead actor and that female actor, phenomenal. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Did they know each other ahead of time? Like, I really felt that was real.
They did not know each other, no. And that was intentional. We did have a Zoom call where we sort of went over the script a little bit, but I told them ahead of time, I said, you know, try not to talk to each other about the scene ahead of time, because I wanted that spontaneity on screen, because the characters, they don't know each other. And this main character, the Undertaker, he doesn't know where he is. So he wouldn't know any of these people. So I made sure that Dustin Toiber, the lead actor, didn't really interact with the actors much prior to that. Way he had a very spontaneous reaction to everything that was going on, especially to the customer, Jennifer Drummond, who plays that role.
So I don't know. I just love that scene. I could sit there for a full half an hour of them just talking.
They're great. Yeah.
What bugs me, I wish you scriptwrote this because I have a better question, but I'll ask you anyway. Sure. I wanted more. I felt this scene gave me pretty much what I needed, but it didn't give me enough of what I was looking for. Like, I really wanted something nailed down. And the problem is the lead actor, whoever wrote the script, goes, oh, I get it, and leaves. I'm like, but I don't get it. I'm so close to thinking I got it. Now, you as a director, not having any bullet points to say, hey, this is really what's going on. You never give me that. did you try to convey that in the diner? Like, you really tried to edit it, get the dialogue to the point, but you will not let me finish it. Why?
No, very little was cut from that film. A lot of what you saw on the screen is what was written. There was one thing that was cut that that we took out just because it just flat out, it just like didn't do it for me. Chris wanted me to keep it. Chris kept pushing, I keep it. I'm like, nope, I'm sorry. We got to take it out. It doesn't work. So, yeah, cause I'm tough on myself when I'm editing. It's funny. The golden rule usually is that directors really shouldn't edit their own. I shouldn't say golden rule, but really directors, they shouldn't edit their own films because they're too close to it. And I certainly understand that. But I don't know. At the same time, I try to look at it as a viewer, you know, but there was one. So the scene that we cut, there is a moment where outside the diner, the Undertaker sees a guy that's dressed just the identical. He's dressed just like him. And he says something to the effect of, I've been here before, same as you, or something like that. And he leaves. And as the identical leaves, he starts speaking in tongues and he's like flailing his arms in the air. And Chris wrote that into the script. We shot it. Didn't work. I cut it out. I don't get what it adds to the scene. Like, I shot it because I wanted to be respectful to Chris's writing, but I didn't really get it. And so then we cut it out. So things like that, that went a little bit too far. I try to be very cognizant of that. I take it out.
I don't think I would have got that scene at all. It would not have worked for me either.
Yeah. Yeah.
I completely understand. Yeah. So
yeah.
Let's back up to the outfits of the actors. Where did you find them?
So some of the suits were already owned by the actors. Jennifer's dress, that we picked specifically, and we found it on – I think we found it on Amazon, actually. And she just like – she worked with my wardrobe designer, Gabrielle Rawson. She was my production designer, really. So she helped me find the car, Gabrielle. She helped me choose the colors for the costumes. Even though it's black and white, we were very cognizant about the style of costume, even the color of it, because, you know, anything that's darker is going to show up more black in black and white on screen. So we try to be very cognizant of, like, what colors would be appropriate colors for what the actors would be wearing. So, yeah, so that we found on Amazon, the waiter's outfit, that was also an Amazon pick as well. And then the car we found through a local guy who does car shows. And that was one of his cars. And that was it.
Okay. You have a shot by the lake of two people talking. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about. I want to say, were you influenced by Frankenstein for that shot? Because I definitely felt I was watching Frankenstein for 1939.
No, I didn't. No, Frankenstein didn't come to mind for that, but I could certainly see why you would think that. Yeah.
Okay. Now, you do have a gun in both these shorts. Is that just coincidence?
Coincidence. Purely coincidence.
Okay. Now, as you were done shooting this and after you've read it, did you not feel this should be an extra 20 minutes just to fluff it out a bit more? Like, I loved it, but I wanted more. You really left me at the end of the film wanting either a next chapter, a previous chapter, or even in another 10 minutes of where I was. Was that ever thought of?
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah, I've thought of that too. In fact, Chris being the prolific writer that he is, he actually did write follow-up script to this film. I've read it. It's very good. It's very good. The only reservation I had was like repeating myself as a filmmaker, where it's like, am I doing the same story again? You know, and that's sort of a concern I had. I mean, but so I could certainly understand that, though. That is a common perception that comes out of anyone who views it. They enjoy it. They like it, but they also wonder, well, what happens next? They're like, what happens? And I'm like, well, you know, you gotta, it's like, I don't know. I don't know what happens next.
I just felt as a director, you would even want to know what happens next. Because you guys just left it.
I would love, yeah. Mm-hmm. I would love to know what happens next. Yeah, no, it certainly caught my curiosity. I think that's one of the reasons why when I read it, I loved it. Because I was like, oh, man, I want to know what happens. I wonder what else happens, regardless if we shoot or not. I'm just curious to see what happens next. And I've read Chris's follow-up, and, I mean, I certainly do see what happens. It's not quite what you would expect, I would say. But then again, that film is nothing of what anyone would expect.
Exactly. Okay. We're time for some fun questions. You cannot prepare for these. But if you've listened to my interviews in the past, which I don't think you have, so you're out of luck. Your favorite film, please, because first time on the show.
My favorite film of all time?
Mm-hmm.
The first Rocky movie.
Fair enough. Now, because you hang out with Scuttle a little too often, I have to give you this question.
Okay.
Your favorite director?
Martin Scorsese.
And I'm going to cheat and change my last question just because I'm going to ask this on behalf of Scuttle. Why has Brian Scuttle never scored one of your films?
That is a very good question. I forget he's a composer as well. It's like one of those things where I forget he also composes. I know him as a film critic, a writer. But yeah, he also does music, and I see that he's starting to score some other films. So I'll have to hit him up for a score. Definitely. I mean, he's got a lot of talent,
and he works cheap. So we all know that. Now I'll ask my real last question. That was for Scuttle, even though he doesn't know he sent it to me. I think secretly he did. Okay. Your favorite on-set meal of your films.
Favorite on-set what?
Meal that you've ever had.
On-set what? Meal?
Meal. You guys always
have meal.
Meal. Food.
Oh, let's see. On-set meal. If you worked on film sets, you know, usually you're lucky if you get pizza a lot of the time. But no, that's definitely not my favorite. I was working on a commercial one time. For Hasbro when I was interning, they had tacos. That was amazing. That's always amazing to have. So tacos is a good one. There was another set where we had chicken parm, which I do love that, but I mean, the problem with that is pasta, carbs, slows you down a lot of the time when you're working on set. So we try not to do that. But I love how any film set, no one ever touched the fruit bowl. No one ever touches a salad ever.
True. Okay. Before I let you go, you better tell everybody where they can find your wonderful film.
Sure. Yeah, sure. So you can find me on my website, which is storiesmotion.com. I'm also on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter under Stories in Motion. That's my production company. I work as not only as a director, but I'm also a cinematographer and editor. My day job is working in television, oddly enough, for A&E Networks. I'm an assistant editor. But I also do commercials, music videos, and I'm always creating something. Working on writing my first feature. That's like another big thing. But yeah, that's where you can find me.
Thank you for your time and have a great day.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to that interview with Simon. Could you please rate and review us on iTunes and Spotify? And if you have any extra change, feel free to send it to us at PayPal. And that's extrafeatures@gmail.com on PayPal. Thank you. Bye.